The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Canada, I am Hugh Hewitt. I'm up in the studio Winterthur in Maine, and I am greeting all of you. As the sun comes up here at like 4 o'clock in the morning, it feels like half the day is done. I am so glad to be with you today. It's the last day of the Supreme Court. A fond good morning to Justice Stephen Breyer, who's been a welcome guest on this program in the past. The great liberal from Harvard Law School in the First Circuit will be retiring at noon today. Justice Jackson will be sworn in immediately thereafter. There will be no cessation in the nine serving. It'll just be a different nine. I think Justice Breyer made a good choice to go off and enjoy his sunset years and do so probably teaching at Harvard Law and I hope appearing on radio shows some more, writing another book, a candid recollection of what he did and how he did it. Meanwhile, the big news yesterday, President Biden, indeed all of the NATO leaders, have sent Russia a, quote, defiant message, according to the Washington Post. Under pressure to find new ways to confront Russia as its deadly invasion of Ukraine drags into its fifth month, President Biden and NATO allies on Wednesday announced a historic surge of forces along Europe's eastern flank and welcomed Finland and Sweden as soon-to-be members as they promised to defend every inch of NATO territory. The muscular military announcements were intended to send an unmistakable message that NATO remains unified against Russia's growing belligerence, said Biden, standing alongside NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg on the second day of the NATO summit. From the Financial Times, U.S. to boost military presence in Europe as NATO strengthens defenses. 5,000 additional troops to Romania. Two squadrons of U.S. fighter aircraft, U.S. F-35s, will be in the United Kingdom. These are good moves. The deal is there's no money in the budget for them. Joe Biden gave no additional money. There's a real cut in the Biden budget, but we're looking forward to the Senate and the House agreeing to fund the Department of Defense so that we can actually do this, rebuild the supplies of the weaponry that has gone to Ukraine rightly. But it is up to you to elect Republicans at every level if you want to defend not only Europe, but yourself from China and Russia. Really two camps in the world now, Russia, China, and their vassal states like Iran and us, you and me and everybody in the NATO alliance. And I would like to include in that the NATO should become NATCO because North Atlantic Pacific Treaty Alliance is what it should be. Wall Street Journal echoes this. The U.S. is to ramp up military presence in Europe. It's not much of a ramp, but it's something. It's more important in symbolism. Russia war in Ukraine drives gains in NATO weaponry. This is another Wall Street Journal story because we're running everything through Ukraine. We're seeing what works and doesn't. We're buying more of what does. There are NATO's expansion is also a subject of a long story in the New York Times because it's a big deal. I'm going to talk with a couple of guests about it today. Ukraine has announced the largest prisoner exchange yet, including fighters taken from Mariupol. Vladimir Putin is, quote, a lunatic with small man syndrome, says Ben Wallace, Britain's defense secretary and one of the heroes of this war in the United Kingdom. Now, on the bad news side, the central bankers got together. You know, that is Jay Powell of the Fed, the European Central Bank's Lagarde, and Andrew Bailey of the Bank of England, and they all agreed the era of low interest rates is done. They're going to moderate inflation, whatever it takes, and they're going to do it quickly. Some good news. Ben and Jerry got slapped around by their owner, Unilever. The couple of hippies from New Vermont who thought that they could boycott Israel, Unilever said, we're not doing that. You don't run this country anymore. We're selling Ben and Jerry's in Israel. Britain is suffering a faster and steeper downturn than Europe, according to the Telegraph. From Israel, and I'll talk about this later in the show with Dr. Michael Bennett, comes the announcement that the current prime minister, Naftali Bennett, is not going to run again. He's out. And his party is going to be led by a new person, Ayelet Shaked. And I'm going to talk with Michael Oren about that later. Pfizer boosters just got a $3.2 billion deal from the United States. They're going to target Omicron, a different mix of boosters, like the annual flu shot. I will get mine in the fall. I hope you get yours. Glenn Youngkin, the governor of Virginia, met with mega donors yesterday amid hints that he is mulling a White House bid. And he would be a formidable candidate, friends. You've heard him on this show many, many times. And if the new governor of Virginia gets Virginia's house in order and continues to win after win and gets schools back under the control of parents and businesses moving there like Lego and Amazon, he will be a formidable candidate in the Republican presidential primary. Lee Zeldin is running for governor of New York, great Republican congressman. So the New York Times has begun to attack him. How Zeldin's anti-abortion stance may affect the New York governor's race. In fact, the big issue in New York is whether or not you want to keep your house. Property taxes are driving people out of their house, and Zeldin will fix that. So I think it is clearly the time that New York State has got to toss out the accidental governor, Kathy Hochul, who is a yokel, and figure out we need a serious person at the top, like Pataki, like the years of Nelson Rockefeller. Lee Zeldin is a serious governing person, and get taxes back under control. Supreme Court yesterday got rid of McGirt, not in whole, but mostly. That's the decision that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her liberal colleagues joined with Justice Gorsuch to overturn Oklahoma's jurisdiction over non-tribal crimes and anything on tribal land, actually. And they pared it back to almost nothing. Cornell University, for all you Cornell people out there, removed the Gettysburg Address and a Lincoln bust from its library after a complaint. That's right. A bust of Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address cannot be displayed in Cornell's library. What morons. Finally, inflation is forcing Americans to change their diets. We make vegetable soup. What a surprise. Joe Biden's economy is crushing the individual American. I want to play for you a couple of quick clips. First, Molly Hemingway last night. Actually, let's start with Brett Hume. Last night on Fox News with Brett Baer, I said grab this because he is slamming the Nancy Pelosi 1-6 committee after the hearsay testimony of Ms. Hutchinson, cut number 11.
What it did do, now that the testimony is being challenged, is it shows why it's not a good idea to put witnesses on that without any cross-examination or any viewpoints expressed from the other side of the issue when there is another side, and certainly it is in this case. This is what the committee has decided it will do. It'll put on a TV production, which is what it has done, and it seems to have tripped itself up on that because the testimony is now being disputed openly by the Secret Service.
But first of all, I said the beast, but it was a smaller Secret Service SUV. Right. But either way, how does this happen in a committee that's that scripted and that laying all of this methodically out? They call this surprise hearing, and then they trip on this, and it opens the door to critics of the committee from the beginning.
Well, I think, you know, it's consistent with what the committee has done, though. When you think about it, they'll call witnesses before the committee, and the witness will be sitting there, and then the committee will proceed to play excerpts from the deposition, the video deposition of the same witness. It's a very peculiar way to proceed. You know, I've been around Washington a while. I covered the Hill for a long time. I don't remember any committee where all the members were chosen by one party. Even the, you know, the minority party's representatives, and they're all on the same page. They all agree. Well, if you don't have any dissenting voices, this is the kind of thing that can happen. Yeah. It's a mistake.
After two of the congressmen were turned down, then the minority leader walked away, but it does not have any pushback. And where does it go from
here? No, you need that to have credibility. You need that.
And so does it have credibility at the end, do you think?
Well, if this blows up, this sensational testimony, which I don't think advanced the ball on the committee's main thesis, but if this testimony, which everybody was, you know, in rhapsodies over yesterday, blows up and is found to be, you know, seriously contested and in doubt, I think that will damage the credibility of the committee and its final work product, whatever that may be.
Brett Hume, of course, always right, or nearly always right. Brett Baer providing him the forum, the opportunity to explain. When Nancy Pelosi set up her committee, we got what Molly Hemingway talked about, cut number one.
If Adam Schiff is saying something, it's a pretty good indication that it's not true. This committee has engaged in widespread manipulation of evidence. They are refusing to provide the testimony of people who dispute the narrative that they're trying to construct. They are really running roughshod over our American ideals of what should happen when you accuse people of crimes and whether there should be an ability to make a defense or have a cross-examination. I mean, those rights are enshrined in the Constitution, and our congressional committees are supposed to honor that in the way that they conduct their hearings. That has not been the case since day one. And today, this was just absurd. And I have to say, if you believed this absolutely ludicrous story from this person, even before it was disputed by everyone on the record, you should not be involved in politics, in journalism, and you should really think deeply about whether you're able to really analyze information at the level that you should.
Yeah.
She's absolutely right, America, and Molly Hemingway usually is. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Come right back on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Words like tender babies.
Casting from Studio Winterthur in the North, joined by Professor Randy Barnett, who teaches constitutional law at Georgetown Law. I was talking with Randy earlier in the week. I'm adopting Randy and Josh Blackman's case book on constitutional law, cases and materials for when I return to the classroom in the winter. And I also asked him if he wouldn't mind coming on to summarize the term, and he agreed, and he got up early at 7 o'clock in D.C. And good morning, Randy. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Hugh. I have to say that I am not in D.C. I am in central Virginia overlooking a lake of the woods. So it's a beautiful morning. The sun is shining over the reflecting over the lake, and I'm here talking to you.
Law professors love their summer vacations as I do. Professor Barnett, would you summarize the term, which is about to wrap up in a few hours?
Astonishing. I can summarize it in one word. It's astonishing. Let me put it this way, Hugh. One of the things that was said for some time, especially after the NFIB versus Sebelius Obamacare debacle that I was involved in, as you know, is that five votes are not enough. You need to have six. It goes to 11. You need one more. So it's like or Ocean's 11. You need one more.
Yep.
So you need six, not five. Six changes the complexion of the court a lot. By six, I mean six legal conservatives of one variety or another. I think now this we finally see the difference between six and five.
That is a great summary. One of the reasons that I'm changing casebooks for the benefit of the audience is that the cases have to change. Everything has to change after 2 years of this. I don't think your full-scale update is due for a couple of years with Josh Blackman, Randy Barnett, but I know you will get the supplement out, and I'll be able to use the video material you've adopted as well, which is very high-tech. Dobbs is obviously number one in the public's mind, but how do you rank the cases that mattered the most in this term?
Oh, well, you know, I haven't had enough time to think about that. I think school choice could end up being the most important case from a policy standpoint, because look what Arizona has done with the law that sends, I guess, $7,000 for every child to wherever they want to go to school.
It's the first backpack bill in the United States. Doug Ducey has really broken the dam on school choice.
Right. And the court has allowed this to happen. Until religious schools were able to participate equally with non-religious schools, the political impetus for school choice was greatly reduced. They did because they it was hard for them to get behind it. And now that they are included on a non-discriminatory basis, which is what the court said had to be, if you have it at all, you can't discriminate on the basis of religion. I think there's a chance that we could break the stranglehold that the teachers' unions and other government institutions have over education. Although, you know, there's always a risk. This is the downside of school choice has always been when you start sending government money into private institutions, then strings follow the money. And then all of a sudden, all the private institutions get regulated in the way government institutions are. So that's always been a downside of school choice that has to be dealt with. But as a step towards, you know, free choice in education, it seems like I still think it's a great step forward.
Well, I think the brace of cases, not only the main voucher case that you just referenced, but also Coach Kennedy kneeling
finally gets it back to where it was intended to be by the framers and the ratifiers of the First Amendment as incorporated on the states by the 14th. It's common sense constitutionalism. You don't establish a religion by having vouchers. Establishing a religion is like Church of England and paying taxes. And free exercise means free exercise. And Coach Kennedy can kneel down at the 50. He's not coercing anybody.
Absolutely. And, you know, there is some reason to think that the Establishment Clause was actually a federalism clause. It basically said that this is something the Congress may not do. And then the question is, did the 14th Amendment adopt a federalism clause and apply it to the states? And I don't think it did any more than it applied the 10th Amendment. I shouldn't say that. That's stronger than I believe. I suspect that it didn't any more than the 10th Amendment gets applied to the states via the before the 14th Amendment, because the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment that says no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, that protects personal rights. That protects individual rights. It's not clear that the Congress may make no law establishing a religion even is a personal right. I would last something about that. Senator Jacob Howard, when he introduced the 14th Amendment into the Senate and explained what rights it protected, it said, well, there's a bunch of unenumerated rights and plus these ones that are in the Constitution. He gave a whole list of what was in the Constitution, but he left the Establishment Clause off his list. If this is true, it just means that we are, in fact, as you say, getting back to where free exercise of religion is what should be doing all the work, not the Establishment Clause.
And Professor Barnett, I have appeared over the 30 years I did pro bono work on behalf of people of faith and churches, usually involved with land use issues. And every single government lawyer misunderstood the Establishment Clause because of Lemon, because of the idiocy of the case law. I think you're just going to excise all those cases, right? Note, there was a lot of bad decisions for 50 years, and now we have a very sound, simple Kennedy case. What about, I listened to Grace Curley, who's our local host in Portland, as I was driving up to the far north on 2 days ago. And Grace had on a Second Amendment enthusiast who operates a gun shop, who basically thinks everyone can carry whatever they want anywhere. I think he is overreading Clarence Thomas's ruling. How did you read the Second Amendment case?
Well, it's very important to me. I'm a concealed carry permit holder in Washington, D.C., and as I explained on SCOTUS blog and on the Vala Conspiracy, I had to go through the 16 hours of classroom training and the 2 hours of range training to get my initial license. And then to get it renewed, it was another 4 hours of classroom and 2 hours of range training. So, and also the considerable expense they charge. So I understand how this right can be has been regulated, and what the court insists on is that, including Justice Thomas, is that he doesn't call into question the current regime of regulation of the right to keep and bear arms, a shall issue regulation that I was able to satisfy in D.C., thanks to a court ruling. I think there's a logic of his opinion that would undermine this kind of regulation. But I don't know if there's 5 votes to actually extend the logic to that. I think most, like Justice Kavanaugh, sort of insists that, you know, according to existing gun laws like this are not going to be touched. So I think we're going to have to wait and see. It was just great after 12 years of neglect to see the court return to the right to keep and bear arms, which lower courts, as you know, have been actively resisting to the point of negating the court's rulings in Heller and McDonald. Speaking of precedent and stare decisis, they were not all that enamored with following the precedent of stare decisis of Heller and McDonald, but the court now has
six votes.
It's the difference between 6 and 5, Hugh.
I agree. And I also say not only is it a 6-judge court, it is also a history and tradition court. If I had to summarize the 2 religion cases, the gun case and the abortion decision, the court has directed those who would interpret the Constitution to the history and tradition in effect in 1868 when the 14th Amendment was adopted and at the time of the Constitution. And that history and tradition, not some judge-made test, but history and tradition rule. Am I overstating that, Randy Barnett?
No, I think that's a good summary. Then there's 2 questions. How do you do history and tradition? Because it's not always clear how you do it. And secondly, what is the relationship between history and tradition and the original meaning of the text of the Constitution? I think they're related. It's not the same thing. And we're going to really need to think harder about exactly how this is supposed to work. I'm not sure I completely understand all nuances of it after reading Justice Thomas's doing it.
You know, what I decided is I had to learn a lot more about 1868. I know the Civil War pretty well. Of course, I know the founding very well, but I don't know a lot about 1868, and I wish someone would write a book about 1868. Let me close with the decision.
Wait,
we don't yet.
Is that a plug for my book, The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment, Hugh?
Yes, it is. I plugged your case book. I know.
I want
professors across the United States to adopt Barnett and Blackmon. I really do, because I want students to understand where we're going, and we're going in history and traditions direction. Last question. EPA is coming down today. Are you hopeful for anything significant, or do you hear a punt coming?
I have no feeling whatsoever. I never make predictions about the outcomes of cases, even especially the ones I'm involved with. I'm not involved with this one. And so I just don't know. But, you know, don't get greedy, Hugh.
Well, I would like to see the administrative say, next term, I want the Fifth Amendment reinvigorated, because I think the Endangered Species Act is a walking, talking, taking.
Well, the last thing I'll say here as you're exiting here is that it's obviously easier to decide a whole bunch of cases this way than only one, because they can't just focus on one.
Agreed. Randy Barnett, always a pleasure. Enjoy summer vacation. Keep coming back. Barnett and Blackmon is the cases and materials you need, and The Original Meaning of the 14th Amendment is Randy's book. Go and get that, because all of a sudden, we really need to know that, because history and tradition rules among the six. Stay tuned, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I'm joined by the next congressman from Maryland's 6th Congressional District, Matthew Foldy. Now, you say, I've heard that name before. Yes, he is a Washington Free Beacon reporter who has left the newsprint business to go off and serve Congress in Maryland's 6th Congressional District, which has been redrawn into a competitive district, although it's a Biden 9+9. Matthew, welcome. How are you?
You. Hey, look, it's great to be back with you. You're right, from the newly competitive 6th District in Maryland that's now an R+1 district, thanks to the work of our governor here, Larry Hogan, who endorsed my campaign yesterday. But yeah, let's talk about the race. It's so good to be back on with you. In a slightly different capacity this time.
Well, now, Larry Hogan has endorsed you. I will add in the Hugh Hewitt endorsement. And I want people, I just tweeted out, to contribute to your campaign, because you've got a deep pocket, desperate Democrat you're trying to unseat. Tell us about what's in the 6th Congressional District so the audience knows where you're competing. I thought it was a D+9, but you're telling me it's an R+1 district?
So Biden won it by 9%, but Hogan won it by 31% in 2018, in what was obviously a great year for Democrats. So ultimately 538 by its number crunching puts it at an R+1. And obviously, thank you for the shout out. The crazy thing is, this is one of the reasons I'm running, is because it's actually cheaper for your listeners to max out to my campaign this morning at MatthewFoldy.com than it is to buy gas. So the last time I was on the show, we were talking about my reporting about how House and Senate Democrats have been using COVID to literally not work for the past 2.5 years. My opponent is the laziest member of Congress. He lives about 20 minutes from the Capitol and skips votes all the time. So the district itself goes from Western Maryland all the way at the end in Garrett County down to Gaithersburg in Montgomery County. And one of the main things that we all have in common is that we have a congressman who doesn't represent us. Right. Shortly after I launched my campaign, I did what I call the David Trone closed office tour, going from each of his district offices that have been closed due to COVID for the past 2.5 years, and said, hey, what we need is a full time representative. So I have the energy to do this. And that's what we're talking about this morning.
Now, Matthew, when you visited those closed offices of Congressman, the invisible Congressman David Trone, staffers are obviously on his payroll. Did he shrink his payroll during the years that he did not have offices open to serve constituents?
No, I don't think so. And the other thing we're also doing is we're also paying for the offices to be rented. It's some of the most expensive storage units in the country. I mean, his office in Gaithersburg is in one of the prime locations in Montgomery County. But when you go there, you have to have a security guard let you up in the elevator, and you see a glass door with a yellowing piece of paper on it that says no one's working here. I just went back to his Frederick County office, and they still have a sign on the window that says, due to CDC guidance, all visitors, regardless of vaccination status, must wear masks indoors. And that the CDC has changed its guidance, I think, 15 times since that was the case. So this is what we need to do, is we need to work together to fire him so we can have someone who will open these offices on day one and then get to work investigating. I mean, you and I are both young Republicans. This is the most corrupt administration of either of our lifetimes. So we need someone who actually has the know-how to get to work.
Now, Matthew Foldy, I actually lap you in the age department, but that's okay. I don't mind young people who have graduated from the University of Chicago, have experience in politics and investigative reporting from the center right. I actually think you'll be a remarkably effective congressman for a long time. Talk to me about, though, how you came to be doing this, because a lot of people will not know you. They won't know your bio. And they're, I only bring on competitive congressional districts because that's where the money's got to go in small dollar donations. And Maryland 6 and Matthew Foldy is imminently winnable. And if we win it early on election night, we will know in November a red wave is big.
That's exactly right. Look, this is the kind of district that we need to be winning in order to flip the House. And it's one of these sleeper races that has only come on the radar since I announced. And the way we know that this is winnable is the DCCC, the House Democrats Campaign Committee, listed my opponent as one of their top vulnerable incumbents about 5 weeks after I joined the race. So House Democrats know that we're going to win here, and they're already freaking out. House Republicans know that we need to win, which is why I've rolled out endorsements from House Republican leadership. Kevin McCarthy endorsed me. Elise Stefanik endorsed me. Daryl Issa endorsed me. Claudia Tenney endorsed me, et cetera, et cetera. Mike Waltz endorsed me. I think I've rolled out 14 House Republican endorsements because they realize that we need to expand the map and defeat my opponent, who's one of the wealthiest members of Congress and also a Democratic Party mega donor who we don't want to have serving in Congress. He doesn't do the work. So the reason I came about doing this is because I was working as a conservative reporter at the Washington Free Beacon, an outlet that your listeners are very familiar with, pointing out massive corruption. So my reporting has led to congressional investigations into the Commerce Department, the Homeland Security Department. My reporting from last October about how Jen Granholm admitted that she violated the Hatch Act just led to her being found guilty of violating the Hatch Act this week. So what we need when we take the House is to have Republicans in office who know how to conduct this meaningful oversight, which is one of the reasons that I'm running. The congressional subpoena is sometimes a lot more powerful than the First Amendment when it comes to getting accountability from Democrats who just don't care, who just don't care about it.
Now, Matthew, you are 25. You are constitutionally eligible. You went to the University of Chicago. Give us some backstory on you.
So, yeah, I'm 25 now, but when I was in college, I actually was the youngest elected official in Chicago history when I was 19. So I feel now like I'm a very seasoned veteran, even though I'm 25. But I was a student there. The Chicago Republican Party recruited me to run for ward committee man. The Democrats were freaking out about my candidacy because the role of ward committee man is chiefly responsible for appointing election judges, appointing Republican election judges and kicking off Democratic election judges. So they recruited a fake opponent to run against me. We pulled her petitions, realized it was one of the most fraudulent petitions ever. Every single one of them was fake. It was families with the same handwriting. It was addresses from outside the ward. And we said to my opponent, look, you can either withdraw from this race or you can go to prison. And she decided to withdraw from the race. So I ended up winning unopposed, which is a little bit easier than when you're running against one of the wealthiest members of Congress, David Trone. So I've been doing elected. I was in elected office in college. And yeah, you're right. I'm 25 now, but I feel like I have the experience now and the energy to do it, unlike my opponent.
I would love to have an investigative reporter asking questions. You know how to do it. Lawyers know how to do it as well. What did you study at the University of Chicago, Matthew? I'm just curious.
I studied political science, which, of course, is neither politics nor science.
Yeah. And are you originally from the land of Lincoln, who moved to Maryland, brought in by your love of the new Rome, or are you from somewhere other than the land of Lincoln?
No, I'm a Maryland native. I was actually Maryland Young Republican of the Year going back to high school, Montgomery County Young Republican of the Year in high school. I'm now the vice president of Montgomery County Young Republicans. So for your listeners who want to join, come to our next event, and I'm happy to welcome you guys there. Happy to welcome people to volunteer on the campaign. We're calling it the most fun campaign in America because we have the energy and the youth that I think you see a lot of other campaigns don't really have. They get older, they get stodgier, but you know, we know it's pedal to the metal between now and November 8th when we flip this district, but we're trying to make it fun for people. We want to make it, and it's important for people to get involved in the democratic process. And I think the average age of our volunteers is 19.
So yeah, I worked my first congressional election in 1974. I lost it, but you're going to win yours. And people at 18 to 24, they love to work these things. David Trone doesn't know what hit him. Did he? I've never heard of the guy, by the way. He is an invisible congressman. Yeah. Is he on any committees? Does he do anything for Maryland?
Allegedly, he's on committees, but he doesn't do anything for Maryland. He skipped 25% of the votes last year, despite living just 20 miles from D.C. And the problem is when he does vote, he votes for crippling inflation. He votes for destroying American energy independence. So it would actually be nicer if he just didn't vote at all. But the problem is when he does vote, it's in lockstep, of course, with Biden and Pelosi, which is inflicting upon us the policies that we need to stop when we take the House, when we take the Senate, and then lay the groundwork, of course, for taking the White House back in 2024.
Now, but you're right,
he's completely invisible.
This radio show covers the southern part of the 6th District, but I'll be happy to come and moderate any debate that David Trone agrees to as a center-right journalist, and he can pick a center-left journalist. He won't show up for debates with you, will he, Matthew?
I mean, he doesn't show up for work. I don't see why he would show up for a debate.
Yeah, that's going to be the problem. So tell me, how do you plan? You know, it's a big district. Geographically, there's a lot of people paying a lot of gas to commute in the 6th Congressional District. How do you plan to campaign? I mean, I'm not even sure what the media market is there. D.C., obviously, but what else? Does Maryland get out there?
And Pittsburgh also, which is why it's important for everyone to donate at MatthewFoley.com so we can stay competitive. We've been on the air for the past 3 weeks. We'll stay on the air through the primary. And you're right, it is a massive district, but it is doable. I've done campaigning where I've gone from one end of the other within a single day. So it's about having the energy and also the desire to go out, you know, to the furthest west, to the furthest down south. But you're right, it is expensive, and it's because of policies of House Democrats that gas costs over $5 a gallon on average in Maryland, right? I mean, when Biden came into office, the first thing he did, as we know, was declare war on American energy. As a reporter, I extensively covered the corruption in the Energy Department led by Secretary Granholm. And we need to actually push for American energy independence when we take back the House, when we take back the Senate. We need to vote to drill in America and let the Biden administration explain why they would rather import oil from our enemies and adversaries like Venezuela and Russia, as opposed to drilling here in America and creating jobs for the people in Western Maryland.
Well, MatthewFoley.com. I have to assume the sad truth that you're a Ravens fan.
Actually, I'm a Patriots fan.
Oh, that's even worse. Rob Lockwood has had a bad influence. How did you become a Patriots fan growing up in Maryland?
Well, I like excellence. I like winning. Oh. I hate socialism. The Patriots have defeated the NFL draft for 20 years. Also, Tom Brady and I share a birthday.
Well, just don't say anything nice about Belichick on this. He drove football out of Cleveland in 1997. Matthew Foldy, I hope the small dollar donors come flocking to MatthewFoldy.com because we need energy, youth, excellence, and vigor. Vigor in the house. Keep joining us, Matthew. MatthewFoldy.com, F-O-L-D-I, MatthewFoldy.com. Thank you, Matthew.
I can't wait for you to moderate a debate.
I'm available. Have package, will call. And if Mr. Trone is listening, I'm available and I'll be fair. Absolutely fair. Now go and donate to him. Please go and donate to him. MatthewFoldy.com. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt up north, but I'm joined by Jim Talent, who I believe is in the heart of the country in Missouri. Eric Schmidt is joining me next hour, Missouri Attorney General and likely to be the next senator from Missouri, Jim Talent. I know you're trying to advise him. I want to talk to you about Biden and NATO, and I want to read to you from the Washington Post this morning, quote, "The new U.S. military deployments to NATO include a permanent headquarters for the U.S. 5th Army Corps in Poland, a move that Putin has long resisted, as well as additional rotational combat brigades to Romania, enhanced rotational deployments to the Baltic region, an increase in the number of destroyers stationed at Rota, Spain from 4 to 6, and 2 additional F-35 squadrons to the United Kingdom." What do you think of that, Jim Talent? Is it taking our eye off the Pacific too much to send 2 destroyers to Rota in addition to the 4 that are already there?
No, it's not taking our eye off the Pacific too much. You, when people ask me what the biggest threat is to the United States, I'm starting to tell them, look, the biggest threat is assuming that we only have to deal with one threat at a time.
Ah.
So we have to walk and chew gum at the same time. Europe is now a net security consumer, not a net security provider. And we are long overdue increasing force structure, particularly in Eastern Europe. So this is a good move, but it points out to you, and I'm very much with you, that the marginal dollar in the Pentagon budget needs to be spent on the Navy, but it shows we still have missions for the land forces. And it calls into question, among other things, the commandant's plan to reshape the Marines, which I respect. But, you know, we still have a need to be able to deter land war, and we do that with ground forces.
Now, there used to be a carrier on station in the Mediterranean pretty much all the time, Jim Talent. That is not the case now. Do you expect to see a return to a carrier deployment to the Mediterranean?
Well, there should be, but we don't have enough carriers. You know that, the sort of merciless 3-to-1 deployment rule. So, you know, you've got 11 carriers. You're going to struggle to have 3 or 4 deployed on a continual basis. We need them in the Gulf. We ought to have 2 carriers in the Gulf and 2 carriers in Indo-PACOM at all time and 1 in the Eastern Med. So that means you're really looking at more like 14 carriers. But we're not getting back there anytime soon. And even I wouldn't build, additional carriers right off the bat. I'd build frigates and submarines.
Well, let me ask you about that. Our friend Jerry Hendricks and I were talking yesterday about the Navy reshaping to a future that is missile-driven. We don't want to have the battleships of the next generation sunk on the first day of any war at the superpower level by missile. Now, we need carriers for everything short of superpower conflict, but they're awfully vulnerable in superpower conflict, aren't they?
Yeah, that's been Jerry's theory, which I think events are proving out. Now, the question is whether we can strengthen missile defenses to the point that we can get carriers close enough to strike in a highly contested environment. And I think that's still an open question. We need to do that. You know that the surface striking power of the Navy is very largely concentrated in the aircraft carrier task force. So I think we need to do whatever we can to keep them operationally relevant in as many different situations as possible. Although I agree with Jerry that, as we shape in the long term, that, that we need a high-low mix, but we need more ships, smaller blue water ships, maneuverable, with lots of missiles, and that means frigates.
I'm just a civilian, but I look at the submarine, the boomers, and two-thirds of them carry missiles, and one-third of them carry cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles, cruise missiles. Isn't there a carrier in the future that is just the biggest missile flotilla, the best defended and easiest to move with hypersonics on it? No planes, just missiles.
Yeah, I think that's possible, although whether we'd call it a carrier, if we're not talking about having, manned aircraft on it, all the forces are moving in the direction of as long a range precision strike as we can get, which strongly suggests missiles and unmanned. I think we're moving in that direction, to the extent I have a voice in this, I try and emphasize the need for near-term force structure because so few people are talking about it. And, we have to have an armed forces for the rest of this decade. But, as you look further out, I think we're going to have a Navy that looks pretty different from the one we have today.
Well, Congressman Gallagher yesterday said we have to focus on the Davidson window. And the Davidson window is open right now. It stays open for about 10 years. Do you think that the NDAA and the discussion is focused on the Davidson window? Do you think any significant percentage of Americans even know what it is?
Yeah, I think Congress is focused on it and the administration is not. And they have some good people in the department. But this is the big question mark I have as they spend really unprecedented levels of the Pentagon's budget on long-term R&D, which is important. Mike talks about this a lot, Congressman Gallagher, and he's right. It's important. But we have to buy force structure in the short term. So, when you're backing off, for example, the F-35 buy, which is what the Air Force wants to do, that doesn't make a lot of sense when you consider that we have to deter conflict through the rest of the decade, primarily in Indo-PACOM, but now also in Europe.
Jim Talent is always on top of these issues with the Bipartisan Policy Center. Thank you, Senator Talent. Follow him very easily at Twitter, at Jim Talent, at J-I-M Talent. Follow me to hour number 2. I'm going to be joined by Aaron Hawley, Senior Counsel of the Alliance Defending Freedom, as we look at the term that wraps up later today as Justice Breyer retires, Justice Jackson is sworn in, and the new Supreme Court. It's just great news every day. Stay with us. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. My attention is turned to Missouri, and a new Remington poll shows that Eric Schmidt, the Attorney General of Missouri, has got 25%. Former governor, the disgraced Eric Greitens, has 20%. And Congresswoman Vicky Hartzler has 19%. I haven't endorsed in this race. I've unendorsed. And the only thing I've done in this race is tell everyone in the United States, and I want everyone to understand, this is a solidly Republican seat. Missouri is deep red. The only one of the people running for office who can lose this seat is Eric Greitens, the disgraced former governor who was going to be impeached, who is involved in the sex scandal, who is involved in the campaign finance scandal, claims he's a victim. He's not a victim. He is a disgraced former governor who is toxic to a vast majority of Missouri voters. Somehow, Eric Greitens has fooled a number of people into liking him. One out of five Republicans think he should run. And that's just residual name ID. And then he ran maybe the worst political ad I've ever seen, one that was denounced by law enforcement throughout Missouri about hunting rhinos. And it just, I don't know what it was, but Eric Schmidt, and that's spelled, by the way, S-C-H-M-I-T-T. He joins me now. Attorney General Schmidt, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Great to be with you, Hugh.
General, I just reported on the Remington poll that shows you're ahead 25% to 20%. That's good momentum. How do you keep that going?
We keep, I think, talking about our message that Missourians want a fighter right now. The primary opponent here quit on the job as governor amidst a bunch of different scandal. And Missourians want a fighter, and that's what I've been doing as attorney general. We've taken on the Biden administration, the first state to sue on the vaccine mandate. We took that to the Supreme Court and won. We've taken border security issues in the Supreme Court and we've won. Locally, we've taken on school districts with mask mandates and won. We've taken on school districts with critical race theory and won. And so right now, I think people look around and they feel like our culture and our country is slipping away. And they want somebody who, reinforcements to go to D.C. to shake things up and help save America. And I think that message is resonating.
Now, Eric Greitens is a toxic candidate. I very rarely say that, but he couldn't win in the fall in 1,000 years. Democrats can cross over in Missouri, and they're trying to nominate him. That did not work in Colorado this week, where Joe O'Day won. I think voting is underway in some counties in Missouri. Am I right about that?
Yeah, absentee voting has started, and we're just, 4 weeks away, essentially, from Tuesday, right? August 2nd. So Missouri's got a pretty late primary, but that's beginning. But the good news is, we've gotten around to the state. We've got county coordinators in every county. We've had the most support financially. I think, we've got the biggest crowds on the ground. And so every measure, we've got the momentum. We've got the energy. And people understand what's at stake, Hugh. I've said it on the trail. I think the next decade is going to be the most consequential decade in our republic since the Civil War. We're going to have to answer questions, quite frankly, we haven't been asked in a long time, about whether we're going to remain the freest country in the history of the world or not. Are we going to have a ministry of truth or not? Are we going to have open borders and amnesty or not? And you better have proven conservative fighters that go up there who know who they are, know what the fight's all about, and are committed to winning.
I like attorney generals as candidates because they have been involved in the front line. That's why the Republican Attorney Generals Association, I've been happy to speak at it. Eric Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-T-T, what is the website?
Schmidt for Senate, S-C-H-M-I-T-T for Senate.com is our website. We're on social media, too, but that's the best way to stay in touch with the campaign, and we're going to win this thing.
Now, I don't advise candidates, and I do wish a couple of these lagging Republicans would drop out. I think you pick up all the, is there anyone going to drop out at this point, Eric Schmidt, to make sure Eric Greitens doesn't get above 20%? I don't even want him to get to 20%. I don't want him in double digits.
I don't think so. I think the field is set. But that's okay. I think the race, as Hugh, the last month, particularly after the 4th of July, more people are tuning in. The race gets more dynamic. And we've got the right message. And you don't have to guess where I'm at on these issues. Some of these folks have been in Congress for a very long time, not really distinguished themselves. You've got somebody who quit on the job versus somebody that is in the middle of all these important fights. And by choice, we've taken on these big, important fights. I mean, you look at the Supreme Court this term. I mean, we were in the middle of the voluntary prayer case for religious freedom. We were, obviously involved in the Dobbs case. We're involved in all these big, important issues because that's where the fight is. That's what's important to this country. It's what people care about. energy independence, energy dominance. We're in the middle of those. We've been involved in pushing back against the Biden administration on Keystone XL pipeline and leasing. We need to be energy dominant again. And so I think we've got the right message. We're getting around, you know, one statewide a couple of times. People know who I am. And
one quick exit question, Eric Schmidt. I had Eric Greitens on once, and he won't come back on. The guy is hiding away from anyone who asks him a tough, direct question. Will there be a debate, or is he ducking those two?
Yeah, he doesn't show up anywhere, Hugh. So we'd love to debate him, but he doesn't show up anywhere and never agreed to a debate.
Yeah, well, you're all welcome here. Keep coming back, Eric Schmidt. I hope your lead continues to advance. I think he'd be a fine United States Senator. Eric Schmidt, go to his website, Get Involved Missouri in America. You can make a small dollar donation to keeping the Senate in Republican hands or getting it back by electing Eric Schmidt in Missouri. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Stay tuned. I'll be back tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.